And I don't want to... I am not going to repeat very much in the way of summary, since you heard about the basic framework of simplified models I'm going to be using only yesterday, which I think was recent enough. Okay. So I do actually want to make one general point before I get going, which is sort of a response to something Jack said yesterday. The point here is really to have, and he said, wouldn't every theorist come up with their own simplified models? The answer is probably yes. Every theorist would come up with them, but the point here is that any theorist's set of simplified models does the job, rather than needing to use every theorist's simplified models separately. So the idea is to have a small number, in our case four, topological models, each of which covers such a broad range of signatures that and tailored to a particular final state, to a particular class of searches, that you just study this small set of models, describe the phenomenology, and it forms a baseline for building evidence for the new physics structure from the data. Now, the context where this makes sense, of course, is that you're working with validated large excesses, things that are stable, that aren't going to go away tomorrow and be part of really standard model. You have signals in multiple channels, and it's not a Z prime. I think these are reasonable assumptions. In fact, SUSY predicts that you're going to see new physics in many channels with comparable rates. And if you take any kind of naturalness motivation seriously, the masses should be low. The cross-section should be large. So this may well be the situation we're going to be in. It's the situation we're in this case study. So I'm going to show you 500 inverse Pico Barn study here. And I want to focus on what kinds of physics we can learn from different distributions and the implications. So by the ground rules for the day, we get to start from the point where new physics has been discovered. And I'm actually going to assume that we have two reasonably large, as you see, well over five sigma excesses in two different search regions in the same experiment. So we have a three-jet, one-lepton search and a two-lepton search. And these are cuts modeled on search descriptions we found online for Atlas and CMS when we were writing our paper. But you'll notice that the missing energy cuts are different for the one-lepton, for the two-lepton regions. The number of jets required are different. And this is certainly the way things could work. So there's a 1,000 event excess in the one lepton events, a 400 event excess in the two lepton events. Comparing the rates of these two excesses is really interesting, and you learn a lot from it, because, for example, it tells you about the rates of different kinds of cascade decays, whether you're producing two leptons simultaneously or not. But you can't compare it directly from this information, because the cuts are completely different. Yeah. These are exclusive one lepton and two lepton samples.
Any of the 420 events is also in the 1100 set or not?
No, so each of the 420 has exactly two leptons, the way I've defined it, and each of the 1000 has exactly one lepton. Thanks. So one thing we could do is take these cuts, tighten them up, and then you'd have an apples-to-apples comparison of the number of one-lepton to two-lepton events. But your statistics in this sample might suffer a lot. Might not even have a five-sigma number once you do those cuts, and it's essentially a new analysis of the data to figure out what the backgrounds are. Another thing you can do is run models through different models to estimate the efficiencies for populating this final state, that final state. That gives you some other sort of invariant sense of whether you're producing more one lepton or two lepton events by how much, if you correct by the efficiencies. But of course, you need to pick a model in order to do that. You'll get different answers depending on which model you choose. So what kinds of models should we be thinking about when we're talking about this kind of final state? Of course, there are distributions in the discovery papers too. I haven't shown them yet. Independent of what those distributions are, as long as they don't have narrow resonances in them or something like that, I think 90% of theorists are going to have the same kind of topologies in mind, are going to be thinking about topologies like the ones you'd get in SUSY. Gluino pairs, Squark pairs, maybe associative production. Now, they don't necessarily think it's SUSY. Some of them might think it's little Higgs. Haven't measured the spins, and right now we don't really care. We want to figure out what's going on in the events first. So I'm just going to use very generic partner names for them. But there's one kind of idea on the table to explain jets plus missing energy that's sort of a clear favorite. And then the fact that you have leptons in the events means that you also need to be getting them from somewhere. So they could be coming from production of top quarks. I'm going to focus on the other possibility, and we have this included in the simplified models. I'm going to focus on the other possibility that it's coming from a cascade decay. So if you want to write down a sort of general form of cascades, you would let the, say, a quark partner, for example, decay either directly to the invisible final missing energy final state, or decay to an intermediate particle, and in the process produce a W, produce a Z, produce an off-shell dilepton pair, always the same flavor, opposite signs, or produce a lepton and a neutrino. And so picking just one production mode and these four cascade decays, trying to fit the and allowing free parameters for cross-sections, masses, and branching ratios, that would be one simplified model, and we have just four of those.
So just one question.
Yeah.
You are convinced that leptons come from cascade decays just based on the total cross-section, it's a strong prediction.
Based on total cross-section and the overall mass. So I have and the fact that these are two or three jet events as well. Now, I claim that I could use this model. So TOPS another option. That would be a separate model. I could use this kind of model too, push it to a regime where it's all where it also looks topologically similar to our parity violating decays. So I don't need to include that as a separate model at this stage. But in this framework, we want to know how do we distinguish the different production modes, the different decay modes from one another? Do we know the masses of the particles? And can we tell whether one of these modes or all of these modes need to be present? And another thing worth saying is that just to get the leptons, at least in the R-parity conserving framework, just to get the jets, the leptons, and the missing energy, we are forced to introduce three new particles. You cannot do it with fewer. You need to produce something strongly interacting, have some invisible particle, and have one intermediate particle that can decay. Then in an R-parity violating scenario, you'd have two new particles, minimally, to explain this signal. So now, as I said, we have many distributions. They tell us things. But there is nothing that these distributions could tell me, short of a resonance, that would really draw you away from this kind of picture. What it does tell you is it tells you something about the parameters. The HT, for example, gives an indication of the production mass scale, really a mass splitting. The lepton PTs tell you about the splitting in the cascade. That's just in the one lepton region. In the two-lepton region, the same kind of kinematics confirms that, suggests whether these are... If you might get a very different HT plot in the two-lepton region. That might suggest that you have two different production processes at very different mass scales. In this case, they look quite similar. And then you also have a lot of important count information within that two-lepton region. And some of these final states, for example, E plus E minus, can come from the same cascade. These guys, opposite same sign or opposite flavor, need to come from two different cascades, and just their relative rates tell you about the dominance of single cascades to two leptons or independent cascades to one lepton each. Now, those branching fractions and for five modes. Of course, they have to sum to one, and an overall cross-section give you five parameters total. And in this framework, there's only one kind of process that gives you emu, ee, or this, or the opposite sign, opposite flavor final states. So we only have three independent counts in the two-lepton data. But there's one additional constraint that you can get from the one-lepton data in this case. Or if you have the zero and three-lepton data, then you get redundant constraints. You can test the model. So I'll include those in the plots, too, even though I just highlighted the one and two. There is one ambiguity that's very hard to resolve, which is, well, a W goes to a final state with one lepton about a third of the time, and a final state with zero leptons about two-thirds of the time. That means it's going to be really hard to use these lepton counts, essentially impossible, to use these counts to distinguish production of a W from the right combination of production of one lepton and a direct decay that gives you zero leptons. So to do that, one thing you can do is just say, I'm going to fix the branching fractions to one extreme or the other. Either all my leptons come from W's, never all my single leptons come from W's, never from this other cascade, or none of my leptons come from W's. And just see how does that systematic affect your conclusions about other parameters of the model. And for example, it has a significant effect on what kind of masses you would want to assign to the different particles to reproduce all the kinematic distributions. It has a significant effect on the total cross-section because when you don't have W's and you're producing just two jets, the efficiency for populating this final state is very low, so you need a much higher cross-section. And you can see, get a sense for how stable different branching fractions are. Some of them are the direct branching fraction is pretty stable to the initial state. LL branching fraction has, I mean, some of them are more sensitive than others. Now, what can a theorist on the outside do looking at the plots? Well, we certainly can estimate from the two-lepton data. We can try to make some educated guesses about the implications of the one-lepton data. But given the size of the systematics that I'm showing you here, for example, a factor of four in the cross-section, dependent on acceptances, I think it's pretty unlikely that we'd be able to do something more sensible to do this with any degree of precision. We really need experimentalists to tell us these fractions in some context with their own analysis. All right, and as I said, I am including a couple of other regions. The distributions can be reproduced pretty well by more than one of these models. Counts, jet PTs, and the HT, scalar sum of PTs, are all reproduced very well. But now, there are many plots that can't be reproduced well. This is probably the single most important slide of my talk. I can't prove it with three plots, but it is true that you can vary these parameters as much as you want. You will never be able to fit these lepton kinematics, the lepton PT and the one lepton plots, and simultaneously the dilepton invariant masses for different choices of those lepton flavors. You just cannot reproduce them in this simple model. Now, this isn't an easy thing to demonstrate robustly. I'm just sketching it, and this is a hard experimental problem. For a theorist on the outside, by the way, it's an impossible problem. If I simulated this in PGS, I got that shape, the data predicts that shape, or even over here, I get this shape, and the data has that shape, I would never be able to say with confidence, oh, that's because my model is wrong. I'd say, oh, well, probably the same things an experimentalist would say if I just try to convince you. Probably you didn't understand your background systematics right, or you're using PGS. It's not handling the leptons right. So I can do absolutely nothing with this data in terms of drawing this conclusion. But a careful inside analysis can really robustly say that this simple three-particle cascade cannot, for any choice of masses, for any choice of branching fractions, cannot reproduce these shapes. And that provides strong evidence that you need a new source of soft leptons with uncorrelated flavor, sometimes singling. So this is providing a solid demonstration of the need to add a new particle to your model. And frankly, I wish this were discussed more in the context of LHC physics, that, you know, any experiment should be building evidence for the particles that it's claiming in its data set, not just plopping down a bunch of superpartners and being happy that it fits. So you can really do it by using a very constrained model. You can really build evidence that you need more structure to explain the data. So
which model did you use to generate your, quote, data?
Well, I'll get to that at the end. And I don't necessarily know much about the identity of this particle. All I know, it's probably weakly interacting is a reasonable guess. So, interim conclusions from the argument I've sketched out so far. The data is consistent with squark production. It's consistent with Gluino production. We don't really know. It could be any combination. We do need these two-stage cascades in order to explain the data. And there's a large rate of whatever's producing the single leptons. So I can play around in PGS, try to reproduce these distributions. Now that somebody has convinced me that they're real, this is a real feature. And I conclude that it's not hard to do with certain hierarchies of neutralinos and charginos. In particular, I need an on-shell slepton to do this well, and a particular structure of charginos. Charginos, I think, in both this and this, at least charginos in the bottom part. So this has another consequence. This is all based on counting arguments. But if I think I really need an on-shell slepton to make this work, well, that has kinematic consequences too. The dilepton invariant mass for same sign leptons should have an edge. Now, I already showed you that distribution, and no edges jumped out at me from this plot. I doubt an edge jumped out at you. But now, knowing that you have some background that you can estimate from the opposite flavor, but also knowing that there's a motivation to think there should be an edge there, one can really do a systematic study. Try to clean up that area, use more sophisticated techniques, try to isolate it with hemispheres, whatever, and see, is there really evidence for an edge in the dilepton mass that would bolster this kind of slepton interpretation of this new state?
Is the point just that the signal's actually contaminating that plot?
Yeah, so this is getting contamination from this two uncorrelated leptons that just happen to be E plus E minus or mu plus mu minus. And, I mean, there are standard ways of correcting, of doing that subtraction. You don't need this slepton argument, this counting argument, to do those. But then, given the limited statistics once you've gotten there, you probably need, probably need some motivation to really go to town and say, I'm going to try to see if that is an edge or not. Okay, so I can find SUSY models with both hierarchies and play around with them. I don't want to discuss too much about the BJET information, except to say that if you have that as well, you can draw further conclusions of the same type. In particular, you'd find that in this data set, the third generation is quite special, in that gluon partners with a 60% branching fraction to heavy flavor actually work quite well. You'd find some bias between that lepton-rich events have fewer BJETs, or B-rich events have fewer leptons. And you need to convince yourself that this isn't some kind of selection bias. If you do that, then to explain these two things, you're led to a sort of discrete set of ideas, and then can tune the parameters in each one of these ideas to find several degenerate models. So here are the three degenerate models that I found, and I'll show you degenerate here is really a pretty strong claim in all sort of canonical, simple distributions. These models really do look the same. So it's not a weakness of our characterization structure. It's an ambiguity with these distributions in low statistics. These are messy spectra. This is the real answer. These are the two degenerate guesses we came up with. The real answer has a pretty heavy Beano that actually plays no role in the events. The others have a light Beano. In all cases, the Higgsino is pretty light. The decays of the Gluino are very different between these models. So each of these, if I knew a particular one of these spectra to be right, would lead to model building in very different directions, trying to understand it in different ways. And it's certainly possible that you'd find one of these models by a parameter scan, and then some persistent theorist would think long and hard to find a degenerate model. And it's not easy to find a degenerate model, especially when you don't have the data in front of you. So this would take a lot of work. But a clear description of the data really helps to bring each of these possibilities to light by highlighting what the physical characterization of what you do actually know about the data.
Just out of curiosity, have you checked that in this particular example, Susie B and Susie C have not been excluded by trileptin analysis at the Kavitron?
I have not in this particular example. These are Higgsinos, so I don't know.
The mass of the Gluinos
are pure Higgsino and Chargino.
Yeah. All right, and these are at 130, so it might be okay. I have not checked that, though. Good question. Now, so as I said, these are not just equivalent in one or two variables. These are equivalent within statistical errors. Just look at all the dashed and dotted lines and ignore the red line that I couldn't remove easily from the plots. These distributions are very similar for the three different models in the population of each of the signal regions, the multiplicity of B jets that you expect, the jet kinematics, the lepton kinematics, even though the sources of the events are pretty different. Now, the good news, okay, so the bad news is that you have degeneracies. We knew that already. The good news is that actually this is a large part of the problem and reduced it to one that a lot of work has been done on, because there has been a lot of attention in the phenomenology community on this kind of point A versus point B. They both fit the data well, reasonably well. Now, what do you do to really refine and pick one over the other? Now that if you can reduce it to discrete problems, maybe theorists keep piping in new ideas to go into that discrete problem, but they have a basin to focus on. One can use all the sophisticated techniques that I'm going to talk about later in the day to try to reduce this and to discriminate between those three lines. So, again, just to reiterate the basic idea here, we have this pre-existing parameter space, and I think having a parameter space, not necessarily literally the one we presented, but something that's widely agreed to be useful, that you just say you're going to analyze if you see an excess in multi-jet plus MET plus any number of lepton analyses, allows you to do a thorough explanation that's also not too biased by what any individual theorist tells you, what direction any individual theorist tells you to go based on a fraction of the data, to at least start out casting a broad net, see what's consistent. I think it's really important to try to build evidence for the particles that you need to explain the structure in the data, instead of just throwing them all out there at once. And theorists can be a lot of help in sort of twisting the data, suggesting what way to look at it, or what kinds of models are worth focusing on. But there's a lot of that that we cannot do just looking at distributions on the outside.
So, in principle, when the excesses are of the size that you're showing, nothing prevents experimentalists to publish these plots, which would be corrected for efficiency and some acceptance.
Efficiency for what signal?
The identification efficiency.
That's right. But acceptance, you don't need sophisticated. You don't need full simulation to understand the acceptance, right? If you have isolated lepton or PPGV.
No, but say you have a trigger to our knowledge that 15 GeV, right? Then
that your electron was 50 GeV, you can unfold. Right? So in principle, all these plots can be made,
proper, you know, corrected to the parking level.
Do you think that's true?
What bothers me is that you said that you then want to do some topological analysis and do hemispheres. And
no, I'm saying one would do. Yeah, the hemispheres was an additional thing that you might be motivated to do. You might be motivated to do a hemisphere search for an inch by based on something you see.
Right, but these are the kind of instructions that would be very useful, you know, again, as a list of the distribution to plot.
Yeah.
But in principle, I don't see a big problem with directing this thing to a particular level.
Well,
so Mike,
I'm... Yeah.
Yeah, but
you'll need to speak up more, Mike.
The history of the Tennyson is very spotty. You guys hardly ever publish it.
Hardly ever saw an exception.
He's absolutely
even standard model distributions took a long time to be corrected to parton level. I thought this was because it was hard to do.
But in all fairness, why would you restrict yourself to these two channels?
No. In fact, I was focusing on those two channels because they had reasonably large excesses and features I could talk about. In fact, we were also using a three lepton signal and a zero lepton bin in many of the plots I showed you were not actually those two channels because you would look other places.
Are you looking into more than three leptons?
We looked. There was not an interesting rate of four lepton events with the cuts we used.
But it is information.
Yeah, yes, and that also went in as a constraint in the fits we were using. It just turned out not to be a very significant relative to the other information.
Not that I want to focus too narrowly on my own self-interest, but what about things like with photons, gauge-mediated Susie-like scenarios?
So if you see an excess with photons, it is easy for me to change to suggest the four simplified models that are interesting in that case. You just take the four simplified models in our paper, you take this missing ET, and you say, actually, that missing ET is decaying to some light gravitino plus photon. And that just goes into the... So it's the identical model, but with a little tail added on. Because that decay is going through such a small coupling, it really only affects that final stage, so all the other arguments are the same.
I probably missed in the beginning. When you said you look for multiple leptons, you also require the presence of jets. Do you vary the number of jets as you increase the number of leptons? Or do you keep it constant?
Yeah. In fact, in this case, again, this was just based on a sample of study, a collection of studies that we found on the CMS and Atlas wikis. We had a two-jet requirement in the two-lepton, a three-jet requirement in the one-lepton, and I think it was much lower and also a lower HT when we went to three leptons. And if we didn't have that, you would have had very small statistics in the two or three-lepton events.
Any further questions? Well, I think we should thank Natalie.